Now I've crossed out quite a bit of my presentation in desperation. So I'm just going to very, very quickly say that as a background, there are about 350,000 deer in Scotland and 19% of them are culled every year. John Berger's essay, Why Look at Animals, has ascended to the top of the required reading list for anyone interested in the field. Berger's claim, which dichotomises pre-capitalist and capitalist societies, argues that in the past, animals were central to human experience. While in the present, real animals have become marginalised and alienated from human life and have been replaced by signs, images and representations. Now, these echoes of once real creatures and relationships are now to be found in zoos, and the relationship between real fleshy animals and humans has become broken. Now, this might be true for many animal encounters. But I think I'll follow other scholars in stating that Berger's essay serves nicely as something to argue against, perhaps because Berger believes it's too late for us to either look at the animal or to be looked at by the animal. I believe some people become aware of themselves as human animals when they look at some animals. Now, I had the idea about this presentation because I realised that there is really a big difference between human-animal relations in the wild and in a zoo, or on a farm for that matter. In about looking, the point of departure is really the gaze of the animal looking back and then reminding the person of his separation from the same animal. Now, how does this work in the wild if there is no sort of enforced separateness? When we look at wild birds and they feel threatened by this, they'll simply fly away. Any wild animal will feel the same way if they are sort of unsure about the roles they are given in a certain setting. Are they prey or predator? Berger's animals, looking back, they're locked up, aren't they? They become passive to the gaze of the human as a potential predator because there's nowhere to escape the gaze. The wild animal of prey does not look back, it flees. A wild predator, like a polar bear, for instance, will attack. And the stalker's gaze isn't looking at a representation of an animal, he's looking at his prey. Most of us recognize the feeling. Rupert Sheldrake has studied the feeling of being watched in his book, The Sense of Being Stared At. He has this idea that all animals can pick up thoughts and intentions and explores both premonitions, forebodings, and precognitions between humans and animals and between humans and humans. He's done research on dogs that know when their owners come home, and he's done research involving sort of people looking at people who don't know that they're being looked at. And his results are pretty conclusive. If someone stares at you, there's more than a 50% chance that you can feel the stare. It makes your skin sort of creep. And you feel that, if you walk down a dark alley, you feel that you're being stared at, perhaps. Perhaps somebody wants to hurt you. And I think both animals and humans are alert to this stare. Now, this stare is the starting point for my analysis, because a deer stalker...
Oh, what happened?
No, it's supposed to be like that.
Oh, sorry.
I'm punishing you one more minute now. Now, a deer stalker is partly driven by his eyes. His prey is trying to hide from his gaze, and the stalker again is trying to sort of outsmart the deer by getting the stalker again is trying to outsmart the deer by getting close enough to kill without getting spotted by the deer. And the deer might have had the sense of being stared at, but from which direction is the predator coming? Hayden Lorimer wrote an article a few years ago claiming that deer stalkers were driven by oculocentrism. In the article Guns, Game and Grandee, The Cultural Politics of Deer Stalking in the Scottish Highlands, Hayden claims that by mastering the Highland landscape visually, the sportsman possessed the landscape, something which was born out of a desire for territorial ownership or voyeuristic pleasure. He claims that the sportsmen who were, quote, equipped with trusty spyglass and a high-powered long-distance rifle fitted with telescopic sight could happily disengage all other senses. Now, although this might still be the case for occasional sporting tourists, I believe we need to modify the claim that it's all about looking. Yes, deer stalking is definitely related to this gaze, mediated by binoculars and the scope of a gun. And yes, a stalker is driven by this sense of steering, but there is more to it than looking. And the sense of looking cannot be isolated from the other senses. Now, I've done field work among the forest rangers working for the Forestry Commission here in Scotland, and with gamekeepers also here in Scotland, and among elk hunters in Norway. And I find the Forestry Commission rangers to be the most interesting, because these guys, they're really professional. And it's interesting to see the difference between the gaze of a ranger and a sort of a sporting tourist who might only go out once or twice a year. The professional stalker works in a different way, as he really embodies the landscape. And you might have already guessed that I'm proposing a phenomenological approach here, both in my thematic and my methodological understanding of deer stalking. And I won't go into this here, Erica, as there isn't time. But I'm going to give you an introduction to how the forest rangers work. Now, during the low season, the forest rangers calculate deer density to know what to cull. How many deer can this particular area sustain? Again, it's about looking. And to calculate deer numbers, the forest rangers, they go looking for poo. So by squaring in ground and counting the heaps of the feces in it, they estimate the deer numbers. Each poo the ranger finds is marked by a lollipop stick, so it isn't counted twice. Based on these calculations, the ranger is then given a number of deer he needs to cull on his particular beat. And the stalkers that I worked with, they had cull numbers of between 350 and 450 per year. The difference between a good stalker and a bad stalker is his speed and ability to locate deer, sneak up to a distance of about 150 meters without getting spotted, aiming at the right spot and killing with the first bullet. The best time to stalk is at daybreak and nightfall, because this is the time of day when the animals are moving about, grazing. Forest rangers will have the use of a 4x4 car and an ATV on a trailer to be as efficient as possible. They'll park the car at the road end and then they'll use the ATV to get close to where they can find the deer. And the stalkers don't just look. During the rut, a ranger or gamekeeper will often hear the stags roaring before seeing them, and they can listen to the bark of the roe deer and to the squeak of the seeker deer to establish their approximate whereabouts. They can stop and sniff the air, trying to detect the sort of pungent and goat-like smell of a rotting stag. But the actual stalk starts by looking, because you need to know precisely where to go. The stalker scans the hillside using a telescope or binoculars. And when the stalker sees the deer, or perhaps just the tiniest tip of an antler, he keeps the gaze and tries to wait out the animal. Is it a lonely deer, or is it part of a group? If it's in a group, where are the others? Sometimes one of the deer will be looking around while the others are grazing, sometimes not. And after a while, the stalker has to decide how to get close to the animals. So he needs to evade their sight and their smell and their hearing. So first he feels the wind. This is because his scent needs to be hidden from the deer's nose, just like his body needs to be hidden from the deer's gaze. And the wind carries both the sound and the smell. And if there isn't much wind, he might sort of pick up some light grass or seeds while he's moving to see which way they drift. And once he's managed to establish the wind direction, he looks at the topography. He then decides how to move up to the deer without being seen, heard, or scented. And this decision needs to be made swiftly, and the stalk up to the beast has to be carried out before the direction of the wind changes, because the animals might get scared by other things, or they might just decide to change their grazing area. Walking with a loaded rifle in an unfamiliar forest, bristling with the signs of prey, is thrilling. Your attention to everything around and deafness to everything else is complete. The quality of this attention is difficult to convey, You notice how the day's first breezes comb the needles in the pines, producing this sort of whispering whistle. You see a ripple in the pattern of light and shadow impressed on the tree trunks and the ground. You notice the specific density of the air. But this isn't an aesthetic attention, it's a hungry attention, reaching out into its surroundings like tentacles. Your eyes register the tiniest hint of movement. In the Sitka spruce plantations that are too dense or deeply shadowed to penetrate with your eyes, your ears are alert, registering a branch cracking or the duck-like squeak of a roe deer. Everything is amplified and your skin is alert. An embodied knowledge of the land is necessary to help decide the best route for getting close to the deer. And any Cartesian dualism is dissolved. Body melts into soul. Everything you feel, see, hear or think is sponged into your body and channeled into the stalk. A hill from the distance may look smooth and accessible, but in practice it's covered in streams, steep gullies and rifts, thickets or woodland, which to the untrained eye might appear to be perfect shortcuts to getting within shooting distance, might in reality be impossible to stalk through without making a noise, due to, again, twigs snapping or branches breaking. So you think your route and you stalk your route. The stalker instinctively becomes more like the animal, straining to make himself less visible, less audible, more exquisitely alert, and his focus is on the deer. The hunter's aim is to kill, and this will happen at a moment he can't plan. Even if there's much the stalker can know about deer, he cannot plan the events of the day, the wind, the rain, the movement of the deer, which branches will snap and scare the deer, and whether the deer will stay put long enough for him to puncture his bullet securely and lethally through the flesh of the deer. The forest ranger's working day is not a walk in the park, nor a visit to the zoo. It's preparing to kill. All his energy goes into trying, by the sheer force of his attention, to summon the animal into his presence. Once the deer is close enough, the stalk, again, is much about looking. How close is the animal? If the rifle is set to shoot straight at 150 meters and the distance is 180, then the bullet will fall a bit, and so you need to aim a tiny bit higher. The ranger will aim and mentally place the bullet in a good spot before squeezing the trigger. When the deer is shot, the stalker will sit quietly for a few minutes, watching it through the binoculars. He wants to make sure that the beast is dead, and by sitting still, the deer won't know what's happened and will usually just sort of collapse or walk or trot a couple of spaces before collapsing. If the stalker rises too quickly, the deer might get scared and use its last energy to bolt into the forest or another place where it's kind of difficult to retrieve the carcass. So the stalk starts with looking and it ends with looking. But the kill is really a battle of the senses and an evasion of instincts. When the stalker is sure the deer is dead, he'll walk over to it and growlach it. He'll then pull the deer manually over to the ATV. And this can be a strenuous activity, as the weight of a dressed adult stag can be between 80 and 100 kilos. And hauling the beast is even tougher when the terrain is steep and wet and the stalker has had to park the vehicle far from the stalking area. So am I just romanticising these rangers, trying to project them to you as more connected to nature, more wholesome people in some way? Perhaps I do romanticise. It's hard not to. And I'd like to refer you to Michael Pollan, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma, and some of you might have read this book. It's a thought-provoking investigation into the edible and inedible in today's world, which ought to be on everyone's to-read list, I think. He ends up exploring what he calls the shortest food chain of all, in which he himself grows and harvests and kills his own food. And the chapter on hunting, an activity which he's never done before and feels really squeamish about, I find really interesting. Mm. Not because of the process itself, but because of the way he describes the use of his senses. Michael Pollan and Michael Pollan's prose suddenly turns purple. heavily romanticizing the way he plugs into and senses the forest when he, for the first time in his life, becomes a predator and not just a consumer. Michael Pollan writes that, searching for his prey, the hunter instinctively becomes more like the animal, straining to make himself less visible, less audible, more exquisitely alert. Predator and prey alike move according to their own maps of this ground, their own forms of attention, and their own systems of instinct, systems that evolved expressly to hasten or avert precisely this encounter. Unquote. Then he writes, quote, wait a minute, did I really write that last paragraph? Without irony? That's embarrassing. Am I actually writing about the hunter's instincts, suggesting that the hunt represents some sort of primordial encounter between two kinds of animals, one of which is me? This seems a bit much. I recognize this kind of prose. Hunter porn. Unquote. Now, Michael Pollan, he concludes by saying that hunting is one of those experiences that appear utterly different from the inside than the outside, and that this was forcibly impressed on him. In Social Formation and Symbolic Landscape, the geographer Dennis Cosgrove explored how two notions of landscape based on pervasive visualism have merged in the West during the last 400 years. And I find this sort of inside-outside or emic-epic stance Pollan refers to fruitful to explore in this context. Firstly, I'll quote Cosgrove. The idea of landscape came to denote the artistic and literary representation of the visible world. The scenery, literally that which is seen, which is viewed by a spectator. It implied a particular sensibility, closely connected to a growing dependency on the faculty of sight as the medium through which truth was to be attained. Seeing is believing. Significant technical innovation or aids to sight, like the microscope, telescope, and camera. Where did I go now? Significant technical innovation for representing this truth included single point perspective and the invention of aids to sight like the microscope, telescope, and camera. Yeah. Okay, so, and then Cosgrove's second notion of landscape denotes the integration of natural and human phenomena, which can be empirically verified and analyzed by the methods of scientific inquiry over a delimited portion of the Earth's surface. Now, Cosgrove's argument is that these two ways of sensing landscape are intimately connected, both historically and in terms of a common way of approbating the world through the objectivity accorded to the faculty of sight and its related technique of pictorial representation. So accordingly, it's perhaps not a surprise that Hayden Lorimer and other academics use oculocentrism as a critique towards a lack of holistic understanding of the environment. In academia, we have a very long history of recording what we see rather than how we feel. And it's all been about looking for a very long time. And the other senses have been underestimated in the European hierarchy of senses. So to conclude, I argue that there is a difference between looking at the tame and the wild animal. If you look at the wild and your role is that of predator, you maintain what Berger argues is lost. Rather than belonging to separate spheres, you both embody the same sphere. To be a successful stalker, you cannot isolate vision from the other senses. About looking has to be about sensing. When we incorporate all our senses, we too are indisputably animals. The sense of being stared at and the sense of staring as prey and predator triggers a whole series of other senses, all culminating in the escape or the attack. Stalking reconnects. While Berger acknowledges that animals still occupy space in contemporary cultures, he laments the disappearance of integrated, mutually dependent lives that humans previously lived with animals, where their respective roles were clearly designated and justified. Although the roles between the deer and the stalker are indisputably hierarchical, The practice and multi-sensorical immersion of the landscape is shared rather than hierarchical. Up the hill, the sense of vision is useless unless it's integrated with the other senses. And this embodiment fuses the hunter and its prey in a way which somewhat erases the human-animal divide. Thank you.